Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities that is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world's changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and that will probably be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you? I understand things are you're in for some rough weather down there this evening in Louisiana.
Oh, yeah, it looks like we could lose power at any moment, so I'm glad you're filling in on the switchboard tonight, just in case I go silent and call in again on the cell phone. That's what's going on. I've lost power. So.
Okay, well, we will plan ahead of time for that particular glitch, and then the other spontaneous glitches that occur will just be magical and fun and wonderful as they occur. Actually, we here in Colorado, we had massive thunderstorms last night, big hailstorms, and fortunately no tornado action to speak of. But I guess we sent it down your way. So hey, enjoy.
Well, our chat host Michael Darling was talking about the storms as well.
Well, actually, we should bring him on. Hello, Michael. Are you with us?
I am, and the storms were huge and not hugely damaging right around us, but on the other side of the metro area, lots of people lost power, lots of hail, lots of trees blew over. It was a big deal.
Yeah, you know, I hear in Wheat Ridge, which for everyone who doesn't live in the metro area, most of our listeners, I assume, a western suburb of Denver, they had hail that was so thick around midnight that they were still like shoveling it off like at 6, 7 o'clock this morning. So it was pretty intense. But not as intense as our summertime series that we're running, our 10-part series, The World Transformed. How was that for a segue, huh?
That's awesome.
I shouldn't stop and admire my own segues, but man, that was good. We've been talking all summer long about the major transformations that have occurred, are occurring, that we are in the midst of, and we've been talking with some of the world's leading authorities on these topics, some of the biggest voices in looking at, thinking about, talking about the future, and we are already up to week 5. Can you believe that, Stephen? This is really flying by, isn't it?
Absolutely. I want to bring these folks on out. Our first guest tonight is Eliezer Yudkowsky. Did I get your last name correct, Eliezer?
Pretty much. Okay. Eliezer Yudkowsky.
Yudkowsky, thank you. He's the world's foremost researcher on friendly AI and recursive self-improvement. He is a research fellow with the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. Welcome, Eliezer.
And thank you very much. Although foremost, it's actually more only, but foremost only, same distinction.
Yeah, well, there you go, yeah. It's like Stephen and I are the foremost hosts of this program, you see.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the way that works. It's great to have you on the program. We've been wanting to have you on for a long time, so I'm glad we finally finally worked that out and actually got around to extending the invitation. I'm glad you were able to be with us this evening. We've also got, returning to Fast Forward Radio, James Hughes. He is the executive director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and he is the producer and host of the weekly syndicated public affairs talk show, Change Surfer Radio. Jay, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Howdy ho.
Well, we're
awesome.
pleased to have you back.
Pleased to be here.
I'm sorry, Stephen, go right ahead.
I was just going to say, we're looking for Ben Gertzel to call in a moment, and if he does, then I'll introduce him. So
we can blame the Chinese, because he's deep in the heartland of China someplace.
Oh, really?
I've noticed weird characters showing up on his chat screen, so I wondered if he was
it's
elsewhere.
It's probably
so
3 o'clock in the morning there, something like that.
Could be a time zone issue, but anyway, Ben, if you're out there, please call in. We'd love to chat with you. Meanwhile, we're going to push on and start talking about friendly artificial intelligence in a moment. First, we're going to stop and we're going to take our two The World Transformed questions, the questions that we've been asking of all of our guests throughout this series for the first four parts this week and for the remaining five parts of this series. We're asking everyone these two questions. And Ellie, I'm going to start with you with these two questions. So question one is, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you have witnessed in your lifetime? And then part two, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you expect to witness in your lifetime, if different from the first answer?
Well, so far it would obviously be the internet. I mean, hey, I'm not really old enough to have seen the printing press, so I'd have to go with the internet. And, you know, it's an obvious answer. We haven't really had all that many major transformations lately. I suppose we could count the disintegration of the Soviet Union or something, but I'll just go with the internet. It's the obvious answer. I'll go with it. What's the greatest transformation I anticipate being alive to see? Well, it's tempting to give some sort of smart aleck answer, like watching the protons decay and having to transition off of an atom-based civilization into whatever it is we go with after the protons decay. But I'll just go with
that.
The
will be a biggie.
That
would be a biggie for sure. I think that's the biggest one we've heard yet. Actually, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead. You were leading to something else, I think.
Yeah, but I'll just go with the obvious one: the intelligence explosion, rise of self-improving intelligence, intelligence vastly smarter than modern-day humans. So just the obvious one. Sorry, I haven't really given a creative response to either of those questions. But I've given the correct ones.
Those are good answers, I would say. In fact, I want to hail all the way back to our first program, because it seems like the internet comes up more often than not as the biggest transformation people have seen. But in that first show, Stephen, was it Reichardt von Wolfschild or was it Alvis Bridges who said coupons was the biggest?
Yeah, I think it was Alvis, but
yeah, I think maybe it was Alvis. Yeah, he said coupons. I'm like, dude, coupons were around before you were born, okay? So you didn't really see that one. No. But
But it's a creative answer.
It is a very creative answer, absolutely. Well, Stephen, I think we might have our other guest on.
Yeah, this
Ben,
is
are you with us?
I'm here now.
Hey, Ben.
Excellent,
welcome
Ben.
To the program. Stephen,
welcome
why don't you
back,
Ben.
Absolutely. Welcome back, Ben. Ben Gerstle. Ben Gerstle is the Chief Science Officer and Acting CEO of Novamente. He is the Director of Research for the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. Welcome back to Fast Forward Radio, Ben.
Well, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Hey, just before we go on with our transformation questions, Ben, since the topic came up, where in the world, and I'm asking this literally, not figuratively, are you?
I'm in Rockville, Maryland, which is in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area.
Okay, you're back from China.
Yeah, I'm back home. I was in China for 5 weeks, and I hope to go back again soon and stay longer. But now I'm back here in Maryland with my family.
Okay, well, that's good. Great to have you back stateside. Great you're back with your family. But that is not as exotic an answer as we were looking for based on what we heard. okay, Stephen, I think you're going to take us to our next.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. James, we're going to address the same questions to you. Ben, we have James Hughes on the line with us as well.
Great.
James, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you've witnessed in your lifetime?
I'm going to just be a copycat with Ellie because it's the same answer. I got my first computer. I started interfacing with computers in college back in 1979. Got my first personal computer in 85 and got addicted to the internet in 1990 and have been unattached from it since. So I guess that's the hugest personal transformation. I think it's probably the biggest transformation of our civilization so far in my lifetime. In terms of the ones that I expect, I try to keep beginner's mind about that. I think there's a lot of indeterminacy about which kinds of technologies are going to whack us in the head in the next 30 or 40 years. I hope that, like Ellie, that I get live to see the decay of the proton, but universe-wide. But thinking about the next 30 or 40 years, it could be any number of kinds of things, mostly technological expectations, although I also have some political expectations about world peace, world war, things like that. But I don't know. I'm pretty open about it, what the next stage is going to be.
Awesome.
And we should specify that it's not necessarily a technical answer that has to be given. You can go with, world peace.
Right.
I mean, this isn't the Miss Universe pageant or anything, but if you want to say world peace, we certainly will accept that as an answer, I think.
I think when the Space Brothers come down and teach us, the secrets of Tibet, that's what it's really going to be.
Oh, shoot, you are on the wrong show, man. There are shows on Blog Talk Radio that would love to talk about what's going to happen in 2012 and, all that stuff for sure.
Right.
Okay, well, let's swing it around then to Ben. Same two questions. Ben, what would you say is the greatest transformation of our world that you've witnessed in your lifetime, and what is the greatest transformation that you expect to witness if it's different from the first answer?
Yeah, I think the greatest transformation of the world, there's a lot of dimensions to it, and certainly the internet and mobile phones and sort of global communication technology is a part of it. So that as everyone else has said, is the simplest answer. I mean, another way to put it would be the emergence of a new layer of collective intelligence that incorporates humans and also goes beyond any individual human into a sort of self-organizing body of knowledge that kind of grows by its own dynamic and works in synergy with humans' thought processes and interactions. And that's been enabled by the internet, computers, mobile phones, and a whole bunch of other things. So I'd rather place the focus on the collective intelligence aspect of it rather than on the specific computer networking technology.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, I think that's a good way of kind of setting the stage, actually, for some of the topics that we're going to begin into. A couple of things you referenced there actually start to sound like answers to some of our upcoming questions. So great answers across the board to the world transformed questions. And I think at this point, Stephen, let's start talking some friendly artificial intelligence with our guests.
All right, I'm going to just throw this out to the entire panel, and let's chew on it a little bit. What is strong AI and AGI, and why does it matter?
Well, by AGI or artificial general intelligence, what we mean, broadly speaking, is an intelligent system that can confront the world on its own with autonomy and independence and can solve new problems that its programmers never thought of in roughly the same manner that humans can, and ultimately with more breadth and flexibility than humans can. It's a bit of a subtle point because an absolutely and thoroughly general intelligence may not be possible without unrealistic amounts of hardware power, yet it's clear that humans have a type of generality to their intelligence that current AI programs don't have and that I believe future AI programs will have. I mean, as to what difference it will make, I mean, creating an AI with vastly broader and more flexible and more powerful intelligence than humans is very likely to transform the world in ways that we are incapable of foreseeing due to our limited intelligence. So I think Werner Vinge hit that nail on the head when he said that one of the key characteristics of the singularity of the intelligence explosion is that we fundamentally can't know what happens next because it involves intelligences as far beyond us as we are beyond a cockroach or a bacterium.
Though there's a caveat I usually add to that,
which has to do with the distinction between means and ends. If you're playing against Deep Blue, which was the chess player that beat Gary Kasparov for the World Championship, you might not be able to foresee exactly where it could move against you, because in order to foresee that, you'd have to be at least as good a chess player yourself. But on the other hand, you can foresee that Deep Blue is going to win because you know an important fact about what sort of moves it's searching for, even though you don't know what sort of moves it will find. And in the same sense, to the degree that that it is possible to shape a superintelligence's goals or even to shape the criteria by which it chooses between goals, you would know an important fact about what sort of plans it was searching for, even if you couldn't predict what kind of plans what exact plans it would come up with.
Is that the same as saying that you would? I just want to make sure I'm following you on that. You don't necessarily know the course of the game that Deep Blue is going to follow in order to win. You can't predict the outcome of the game, but you understand basically how the strategies are formulated, because if you program that computer, you at least set those strategies in place. Or to take it to a much more basic example, you know that the Deep Blue is going to move a knight a certain way, is going to move a pawn a certain way, because that was programmed in.
That sort of thing is not programmed into Deep Blue. What it's doing is searching. It's looking at, it's taking different possible moves and saying, well, if I move here and Gary moves here and then I move here and then Gary moves there, and it's doing this for 2 billion moves per second, so there's no earthly way you can tell it's going to move a knight, and you may not know what it's trying to do, what sort of strategy on the board it's carrying out by moving the knight. All you know is that at the end of this game, it's going to win. And because chess is a zero-sum game, you're going to lose. But there might be other sorts of winning, as it were. So there's you don't necessarily understand the particulars of the search that it's carrying out through the possible chess strategies. You may not be able to understand the what it's doing even after you see it, but you know where it's going at the end of the road. You understand the destination even if you don't understand a single thing about the journey. You know it's going to win.
Okay, and we'll come back to the idea of the destination a little bit later, too. That's very interesting stuff.
All right. James, why is AGI important? Why does it matter?
Well, I think I agree with both Ellie and Ben that the capacity to develop greater than human intelligence in machines will enable, could potentially enable quite a few world-changing possibilities, some of which could be good, some of which could be bad. I guess I'm, you know, I think that there's a certain amount of, there's a certain set of assumptions that both Ellie and Ben bring to the table about how AI is going to develop and what it's going to look like that I don't necessarily share. And one of them was just expressed by Ellie, the notion that you could propose that there would be an intelligence greater than human that you could somehow predetermine some of its ends. I've always found that a puzzling idea. But at any rate, I do think that this is one of the many possible technologies that could be profoundly world-changing, and I guess I agree that it may be the first among all of the possible technologies in terms of its world-changing potential.
Okay, well, let's get into that world-changing potential a little bit. I've got a follow-up to Stephen's question. Having laid out a kind of a broad definition for what we mean by artificial general intelligence or strong artificial intelligence, my question would be, whatever we've defined it to be, is it the next step in human evolution, or is it the introduction of something completely new? And we'll start where we just left off. Jay, you can take that one.
Well, it's interesting. On the World Transhumanist Association now, Humanity Plus talk list, we've been having a bit of a discussion about this last week because of a piece that my colleague Mike Treader published recently about the singularity. At any rate, there seems to be one extreme of opinion, which is that whatever comes of the intelligence explosion, whether it's silicon, nanotechnology, computronium, wipes out all human beings in the process, so be it. That's, the telos of creating greater than human intelligence is sufficiently self-justifying that whatever consequences come in its wake are fine. And the other is that we should fear this possibility to the extent, and not very many people in our milieu say this, but lots of other people in the world do, that we should fear this possibility and try to prevent it at all, however we can. So there's a range of opinions about this, and what I found very puzzling about the debate is that there some people in the debate seem to hold both positions at the same time. They seem to think that there's a 99% possibility that we're going to get wiped out by this stuff, but yet we should forge ahead, full speed ahead. So I don't know if that's an answer to your question, but that's what I found most interesting about the debate myself. And I think that when I have looked back at previous expectations about world-changing events, most of which were non-scientific, non-empirical expectations, religious and cultural expectations. When I've looked back to those, you see the same kinds of things. You see, for instance, Christians believing that there's a predetermined outcome to human history, but nonetheless, we all have to fight Satan because otherwise something might happen, to this predetermined outcome to human history. And I just see the same dynamic at play in this debate. I've gone off on a tangent. Go ahead.
Well, that's very very interesting that those dynamics can recur in different settings throughout the ages as we deal with different models of history unfolding, or as maybe new versions of the same ideas or new packaging of the same ideas come online. But
I'm a sociologist. So that's what I bring to the table.
There you go. That's your deal. But just to nail you down on this, so is it the next step in human evolution or something completely new?
That was your original question, wasn't it?
Yes.
I don't think that it can be properly defined as the next stage of human evolution if it wipes out all humans in the process. And so that was where I originally started, which is that there are some people who do think that it would be the next stage in human evolution if we produced mind children that somehow inadvertently or intentionally wiped us all out. I don't think so.
Okay. All right. We'll move that one then on to Ellie. What do you think?
Well, actually, I'm sort of interested in seeing how Ben Goertzel handles this one. So if we can move on to Ben Goertzel next instead.
And then we'll swing it back around to you. Okay, Ben, you're in the hot seat. Is AGI the next step in human evolution, or is it the introduction of something completely new?
Well, it could go either ways, or it could go both ways. I think if we develop AGI through a cyborg approach where we combine with AIs by hooking them into our brains and connecting them via the global brain with us on the internet, there could then be a continuous progression from human mind into 90% human, 10% cyborg mind, then 50% human, 50% cyborg mind. Then I think it will feel like a kind of continuous evolution from humanity into new forms of thinking, being, and feeling. Whereas if we simply create AI systems that think and operate separately from us, and these AI systems then revise and improve themselves by mathematical principles, it may be the next stage of evolution of complex structure in the universe, but not really the next form or the next stage of humanity. So I think it could go either way, and potentially it could go both ways in parallel.
I agree with Ben.
Do you think there's a scenario where it AGI is the result of some wholly constructed process, not built upon us through the cyber route you were talking about, where at the end of that process, you've got an intelligence there that still identifies itself as us, that looks at humanity and says, that's where I came from, and I am an extension of that. Or are those two necessarily exclusive of each other? I guess the question is, does the human brain have to be involved one way or another in order for whatever comes next to be sort of a continuation of who we are?
Well, that's kind of a funny question. I mean, anything involving humans involves the human brain in one way or another. So
that's a good
answer,
point.
The answer must be yes. I mean,
I mean indirectly, as opposed to building something off the brain, right, or reworking the brain, a product of the brain rather than a product built on the brain, I suppose.
Well, I don't think we can fully understand all the future technologies that will be possible. So then the extent to which we could kind of synergize with other technologies through clever user interfaces that haven't been developed, or the extent to which AI technologies could understand us or reconstruct us from text we've produced or watching us on video. I mean, there may be a lot of potential ways for advanced AI systems to kind of cyborgically synergize with us without tapping into our brains that we just aren't aware of right now. So I'm not sure the question's well formulated.
Okay.
I don't want to get geeky too fast on it, but this is a basic philosophical question. When is something the same and when is it different? And it's the same question as with personal identity of a person, you know, that we're constantly changing. And the Buddhists say that as a consequence, you're not the same person from minute to minute, and other people think you are. So some people think that we stopped being humans when we got, you know, contact lenses and artificial organs, and some people think we won't stop being humans when we turn into silicon uploads. I don't think that there's a clear answer philosophically one way or the other to this. It's pretty gray. But I guess my concern is the one that Ben articulated, which is that there is such a radical discontinuity if we have the next stage of human evolution involves the complete severing of all the organic impulses and, you know, empathy and all the things that are the product of organic brains, and intelligence, it just becomes a matter of computation. That's a pretty radical. Hold on over here.
I feel I have to object to the notion that emotion is a product of carbon atoms rather than silicon atoms. I don't think the periodic table is the key thing over here. If you write the software one way, you have emotions. If you write it a different way, you don't have emotions. It's a software issue. So
I agree, but I think Ben's suggestion that the coevolution of artificial intelligence with organic brains is far more likely to give us emotional, intelligent machines than the independent evolution of intelligence and machines.
Well, I think...
I don't think he actually said that.
Yeah, let me just respond to that. I think the coevolution of humans and machines is much more likely to give us machines with human-like emotions, but I wouldn't assume that closely human-like emotions are the most powerful or the most worthwhile kinds of emotions.
Oh, that's interesting.
If I can, I think that there's a really, really large design space of possible minds. And human beings, I mean, if you visualize this vast city-sized design space, and then you visualize, you know, a sort of small dot in one corner of the city, and that dot is all the human minds that have ever existed, that's sort of the amount of design space that there is to be explored versus how much we've explored already. Now, just as the vast number of ways you could put together a heap of car parts won't make a car, I would similarly guess that even among functioning minds, the vast majority of minds in mind design space are probably minds that we would not find very sympathetic. Their goals might be things that, you know, we're not that wouldn't seem so much mysterious and intriguing and difficult to understand and high and comprehensible in human beauty as rather things that just struck us as completely pointless. And I do think that there's that the sort of difficulty and danger of this problem comes from the reaching into mind design space with a shaky hand. So even if you just sort of make a vague effort, oh, well, we're going to just, you know, try to hack up something that seems sort of vaguely nice at the time and trust that when it grows to be a superintelligence, it'll still seem vaguely nice. I would entrust that sort of thing to Earth. And I guess in a sense, I
like your metaphor, LA, but I guess what I'm saying is that the human continuity question in that metaphor is the problem of connecting the A1 dot to the B5 dot. B5 might be a very interesting mind space, but if it arises independently of the A1 dot without there being a natural linear progression from A1 to B5, that we will consider it to be the successor of human beings.
This is a big space. There's lots of possible progressions from out of the human dot.
Just for a minute, if I could, Ellie, let me explore that, because if we're talking about this very broad possible design space of minds, and if most of them, if realized, would not necessarily be sympathetic or friendly to us, and if we need to go in using a steady hand, I'm capturing your points correctly, then would it not make sense for us to go in attempting to, I guess, do what we know, right? That the artificial intelligence we want to create would have to be, therefore, similar to us. We shouldn't try to make the step from A1 to B5. I'm sorry if I missed that. But
you don't know how a human mind works. This is not something that you know. This is something that you have the illusion of knowing.
Well, yeah. I almost made a sexist joke there, but I'm going to be cool.
But okay. The white dudes.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how most human mind works, that's for sure. Okay, so...
But you think you can build one?
But surely I know more about how a human mind works than I do about a completely alien mind would work, right?
Well, yeah, but no offense, in both cases, it's very little. I mean, you couldn't build either of them.
Okay. So being human doesn't help us create an artificial intelligence.
It certainly does.
It could give you the illusion of understanding.
I think being human is a big source of knowledge that's useful for creating AGI systems. Obviously, it's not sufficient.
Obviously not sufficient. It's a start. Okay, we can. And Ellie, I don't know, we swung around this so far. Did we give you a chance to respond to the actual question? Would you, in your mind, would you say that that AGI is the next step in human evolution, or is it the emergence of something completely new?
No. In particular, I wouldn't use the term evolution, because evolution to me means natural selection by differential replication, and that's something that I think is on its way out one way or another. But if you talk about, is it the continuity of, as it were, the human adventure, then I would say if you can reach into mind design space with a very steady hand, then you could pick out an AI that would help us continue the human adventure. And if you don't do that correctly, or you don't even try, you're doomed. And I think it actually pretty much is that simple, but hey.
Oh, bobbing for AI. You got to get the right one, huh?
That bobbing is not really going to work.
I don't feel like it's that simple myself, but I think this digresses us into all sorts of other issues. I'm not sure what direction you want to take the conversation in.
What I want to say about the conversation is that you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about artificial general intelligence, and we're going to start talking about friendly artificial intelligence. If you're interested in this discussion, you're listening live, please join us in our live online chat or leave a comment at blog.speculus.com.
James, last time there were two different sorts of intelligences on this planet. One was Neanderthal, and then the other was us. That didn't last. Apparently, one wiped out the other. We apparently,
yeah.
I something happened to the other guys, and they're no longer with us. So, I mean, does that bode well for us in as we approach an era where there's another type of intelligence? I mean, what do we do to raise these guys up right so we can coexist?
Well, I mean, this gets back to the question of identity. Is it meaningful to say that human beings ate Neanderthals? Because human beings were also eating each other, and we were also killing each other at a very high rate until this last century or so. So I don't think – I'm not worried in a speciesist sense, in a racist sense. It's not because, you know, that I'm a human racist that I'm concerned about the this next stage of evolution. I think what we have to get back to is some basic questions about values, which is what is it about the human project that we value, about human experience, and what kinds of beings and how should they relate to each other do we want to create in our future? And what I worry about with AI is that it's just so radically alien and novel that it's very likely that it will not preserve any of the things that I consider valuable about human experience. And that's why I very much value the discussion about friendly AI, because the discussion about friendly AI is, in fact, a discussion about how to embody those values in machine minds. I have other problems with the friendly AI discussion, but that project, I think, is extremely important, because I do think we want to make sure that machine minds, as much as possible, are a continuation and not a discontinuity with what we value about humanness.
Ben, do you have any thoughts about how we can stack the odds a little bit in our favor?
Yeah, the first thing I want to say is that I think the analog with Cro-Magnons and Neanderthals is not likely to be very helpful. I mean, that was a kind of natural evolutionary dynamic, whereas we're dealing with engineered systems now. And also, it's not likely that either the Cro-Magnons or the Neanderthals were really reflecting about the overall long-term process that they were a part of. So I really don't see the two situations as all that similar. I think that
good.
Honestly, getting any kind of guarantee of the preservation of humanity after superhuman AIs are developed is not going to be possible. I think we can do things to militate in favor of the survival of humanity, and this actually gets into an interesting conversation I was having with Raj Dai, who's a friend of mine, who is making a documentary on AGI and the singularity, and was with me in Hong Kong and China filming myself and Hugo de Garis and others for the documentary. And Raj and I had a conversation about whether we would mind if all humans chose to become radically superhuman and give up their humanity in favor of something they considered better. And my attitude was, hey, you know, if every human being decides of their own free will, and I'm not much of a believer in the freedom of free will, but that's another story, but if every human being decides of their own free will they want to get rid of their humanity because another form of experience is just a lot better in all the ways that are important to them, you know, I'll be happy for them all. I don't see any problem with that. And I would probably make that choice myself. But Raj, on the other hand, he thought that would be a shame. He's like, no, there should be humans. Humans should continue. So I said, well, what? Are you going to force a certain number of people to remain human, even though nobody wants to? Because they see that other ways of existing are more emotionally rich, more satisfying in every way. And we just had a different outlook on that. He really felt it was important that humanity must persist, whereas it's important to me that everyone gets a choice to remain human if they want to. And I actually doubt that a lot of people are going to make that choice because the human condition has a lot of pretty severe problems associated with it, as we all know in our everyday life. And I think that we're going to invent much better ways to be than the ones that are implied by the constraints of the human brain and body.
Oh, I think of the Amish when that subject comes up. I mean, it seems to me that there'll always be a remnant who would opt to stick with the old human model, no matter how good the next model is.
Might be, might not be. I mean, that's hard for me to predict. And to be honest, it's not the most interesting question about the future to me. Just as the Amish right now are not the most interesting thing about human society to me.
Yeah. All right. James, have we gotten to you on this issue of friendly AI?
Well, I've said a couple things. Just on the issue of preserving humans, I totally agree with Ben that I think we want to maximize individual choice. And while there may be always people who preserve human 1.0, I think most people will eventually decide to take advantage of human enhancement. But I think that there's an easy conflation here of the discussion of AI with the human enhancement debate, because it's not at all clear to me that, as Ben has suggested, the optimistic path, as Kurzweil has suggested, the optimistic path for AI is that it merges with human enhancement somehow. But it's not at all clear to me that that's the necessary path that it would take. And so I think we have to keep those two discussions relatively separate. I'm all for human enhancement, and insofar as the development of AGI or AI serves the goal of human enhancement and the extension of human capacities and the further development and eventually the development of post-humans, I'm all for that. What I'm not all for is the creation of some new novel life form which has values that are radically alien, which might wipe us all out.
Well, that's interesting that you would say that, because, in fact, that's where this conversation this week has kind of connected with the program we did last week, which was on the subject of human enhancement. And we ended talking about, in fact, I did a blog post later in the week on this subject of addition by subtraction, capabilities that you can add to a human being by taking things away. And the example I had given on the show was, you can make somebody the best salesman in the world if you take away most social anxiety and fear of rejection. You might not make a terribly pleasant person. You might not make somebody you want to hang with. But that individual could achieve tremendous success as a salesman. We got talking about what if you start pulling other pieces out of the good side of what we think of as, human behavior, the human psyche, and the subject of, if you pull all empathy out of a human being and you're left with a sociopath, might be some tremendous advantages, getting ahead in the world for sociopathy, but it's not the kind of enhancement that we're, not the direction that we're hoping to see enhancement go. And I think that goes to this same issue that we're talking about here. Ben, when you say that people don't want to stay human, biologically, that's true. But I hope that people want to stay friendly, right? We talk about friendly AI. I hope people want to continue to be nice, that they don't edit decency and goodness out of what they are or out of what we build next. And I'm sorry, somebody was trying to jump in there. I didn't mean to step on you.
Or get nicer.
Get nicer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a key point. Human ethics is not all that great, as is shown very clearly by recent and ancient human history, right? So I think just as we can make AIs that are massively more intelligent than us, potentially we can make AIs that are massively more ethical than us. We're not the peak in either of those regards.
Yeah, I would agree that we're certainly not the peak. And Jay, so when you say you don't want something new with new values showing up, if it's improved versions of the ones we have, maybe that's okay.
Right. I mean, and again, I don't discount the possibility that develop new codes of ethics that are superior and far more complex. And the example I think of is that 1,000 years ago for Greeks, or 2,500 years ago for Greeks, one of the highest virtues was to die an honorable death in battle. And thank God that, you know, most of the men of our age, at least, see dying an honorable death in battle as the highest virtue of life. And so there is evolution in values, and I expect that there will be again. So I'm not discounting that possibility. But what I want to see is some kind of continuity where there's a stepwise progression to that path, and not just suddenly something arises and transplants everything, because I wouldn't consider that to be, as you originally asked, a successor to the human project.
Yeah, I mean, this ties in with my own personal goal, which I've thought about a lot, and I think what I would like to see happen to myself is to see my intelligence increase and my mind broaden at a kind of modest pace per year. Say, become 25% more intelligent each year over a long period of time. So I can feel myself becoming a god. I mean, the way I figure it, if I become a million times more intelligent than I am now in 1 second, or even in a week, I'm basically just killing myself and being replaced by some supermind. I mean, there's not going to be continuity there on the scale of my own mind. Whereas if I ascend gradually to a tremendously superhuman state, then I'm going to feel myself transcending. I'm going to get the process of transcending as well as the end goal. And I remember Eliezer saying somewhere or other a long time ago that he didn't know if the real value was in the process of getting there or in the end state that you arrive at. And I guess I don't know either, so I figure I'd like to have it both ways. Enjoy the process and the end state.
Well, it certainly
can
sounds
anyone
like
hear
fun.
Me, by the way?
Yes, we've got you, Ellie. Thanks
okay,
for,
good,
for
good,
dialing
good.
Back in. Welcome back to
yeah.
the show.
So I just wanted to briefly state that these days I am leaning toward the journey, particularly because if you imagine the case of having actually infinite computing power available, so that no matter how large you were, you could always be 10 times as large as that. That sort of begins to make you question, you know, as there's got to be some sort of point where you can accept the notion of just continuous growth over time if there's no maximum that you can just run out to. And if that's true with infinite computing power, why not with finite computing power?
Of course, once you get to infinite, right, there's hierarchies of infinite numbers.
Well, we just don't know. I think once we get sufficiently far beyond our current state of knowledge and intelligence, we're really just babbling in essence. I don't think we can really, with any integrity, see too far beyond our current condition.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't really know what I want to be, you know, more than, say, 10,000 years out or whatever. I'm a short-term thinker. I take my life one millennium at a time.
Very good. Okay. I think we can all learn from that example. That's terrific. Well, let's carry on with talking about friendly artificial intelligence, and I want to continue to define what we mean by that by asking this question, and since we lost you for a minute there, Ellie, I'll start with you on that, especially since you've given us this disciplined view of the world, one millennium at a time. What is friendly AI to this extent? How is a world that has friendly artificial intelligence in it different from the world we currently live in?
Depends on how powerful the friendly superintelligence is. Am I allowed to assume that it's billions of times smarter than any individual human and is armed with molecular nanotechnology?
Yes.
Okay, the world looks completely different. It looks the way that the world would look if it had been intelligently designed rather than just happened. And it doesn't look completely like that because we're still starting with this world as a baseline. The hospitals are empty of sick people. People aren't sort of working all day long at terrible jobs that slowly drain away their life force or quickly drain away their life force for that matter. People have moved on to different things to worry about than global warming or how their bodies are slowly disintegrating from old age. And now you're going to ask me, yes, but what do they actually do all day, right?
Yeah, what do they do all day? Thanks for bringing that up.
Can I ask you a question, Ellie?
Sure.
In your conception of friendly AI, do those friendly AIs have self-interests of their own?
I think, when I sort of try to envision out the particular chess moves, as it were, it seems to me that the first AI you built, you would want to make very sure that it wasn't a person itself, and that it didn't, and that its models of people were not people. So in other words, when the AI looks at you and says, what is the simplest explanation for this person, the explanation that it formulates is not actually a simulation of you so detailed as to count as a person in its own right.
I'm not following. So there's an organism, some kind of self-willed intelligence out there. Does it have a self-concept that it wants to preserve and therefore some kind of self-interest of its own?
It has interests. You know, there's a difference between interests and self-interests. It has other interests.
So it only has your interests. It only has our interests at heart. It doesn't have any interests of its own.
That's what I envisioned for the first one. Now, later on, when humanity has grown up a bit further, maybe, and is ready to tackle the even deeper ethical issues associated with creating an entire new intelligent sentient, sort of self-interested ends in itself rather than means a whole new intelligent species that would not be just exactly like us but would have its own coherent way of living that by our lights makes a positive contribution to the universe, then we'll be playing around in the part of the design space that's people. But I want to keep my fingers out of that part of the design space to start with, so I don't burn someone else's fingers.
Okay, can I ask Ben then a cross question? Ben, is your understanding of artificial general intelligence also one where it could have only the interests of others at heart and not have any interests of its own?
Well, I'm not sure that's a well-formulated question. And it's pretty hard to answer it at this stage. I wouldn't say I could confidently rule that out and say it's impossible, nor am I confident that it's really a feasible way to build a mind with the kind of resources we'll have at our disposal. I mean, I'd have to just say I don't know. I don't think that's the way it's going to happen, although whether or not it's possible for it to happen that way.
So you think it's most likely that AGI would have interests of its own?
Yes, I think that's most likely. But whether it's in principle possible to have an AGI that only had the interests of others in mind, I mean, the question there is, if it has the interests of others as its sort of top-level goals, does it have to create sub-goals which effectively reflect its own interests? And then is it rational enough to really pursue those quasi self-interested sub goals only as sub goals of the other interested super goals? And this all becomes quite complex, and then I don't know the answer. I just suspect that that's not the way it's going to come about anyway.
Go ahead, Ellie.
I just would like to point out that on the simplest sort of theory of mind we presently have, decision theory, the answer to those questions is pretty straightforwardly yes. You can have any utility function, and if it's an ideal rational agent, it will have instrumental values, but it will not, as it were, pursue instrumental values at the expense of terminal values. That would be a sort of type error.
I was going to say that same thing about utility theory and instrumental values. But my other way of putting it might be, James, since I'm sensing from you is some skepticism on the idea of something that has only the interests of others and no self-interests. Didn't you ever have a grandma, man? I mean, there are human beings, right, who effectively have no interests other than interests in others. Why would an artificial intelligence that functions that way be such a leap?
I don't think you knew your grandmother very well. I think all grandmothers had interests of their own as well. I mean, the history of organisms, so far as we know them, are that they all have interests of their own, or at least interests coded in genetic replication of some kind. I have something right in front of me that's more intelligent than I am and has no interests of its own. It's my laptop. And if what the proposal is that we're going to create more and more powerful laptops that have purely instrumental goals of human beings and no goals of their own, great. There's no problem there, except that, you know, who controls it? You know, is it going to be Kim Il-sung or, you know, Ahmadinejad who's going to control it, or me? But if it's going to be something that has interests of its own, which I think is the Terminator problem, then we have a huge problem if it's going to be more intelligent than us.
You're conflating two issues here, though. There's the question of whether it has long-term goals in the real world, which it makes its own plans to pursue, rather than receiving a continuous stream of human instructions, versus are those long-term goals sort of strictly protective of external interests, or are those goals to get more memory, more resources, more space for myself? You know, that sort of internally directed utility function is actually a very special case. And there's actually plenty of organisms in the world that can't reproduce themselves but have relatives, such as sterile ants, for instance. And exactly in accordance with evolutionary theory, they behave as if they're entirely interested in their relatives and not at all in themselves. Self-interest isn't the rule that we learn from looking at evolution. What we learn is that evolution can build any kind of mind it likes, and it builds minds that follows the chain of genetic interest.
Well, I suspect that both self-interest and other interests and the fiction of a perfectly rational agent and all these things are constructs of our very limited human mentality, which are unlikely to be highly relevant to the actual mind states and goal systems of superhuman intelligences.
Okay, so who doesn't feel like they've had a chance to offer an answer to the question of how is a world that has friendly artificial intelligence in it different from our current world? Did everybody get a shot at that one?
I did not answer that question.
Oh, go ahead, Ben.
I think Eliezer already gave a good answer regarding the kind of external physical conditions of life. So I'll give a complimentary answer regarding the internal conditions of life and subjective experience. I think one of the things I look forward to when I think about the singularity is just being able to have states of mind and states of experience going far beyond what the human brain can support by expanding my mind through merging with AIs, expanding my brain matter, uploading, or what have you. I think right now I'm constantly frustrated because I can't do everything I want all at once. I mean, I can't meditate and feel enlightened while proving mathematical theorems, while having sex, while playing with my children, while writing a novel, while taking part in sports. I mean, there's so many complementary things we humans can do, and we have to make all these horrible choices about how to spend our lives. And this is the kind of thing that led the Buddha a while ago to say all existence is suffering, meaning the everyday human experience kind of sucks, even though it has its good points. And I think we're going to be able to enter into states of mind that combine the best aspects of physical gratification, intellectual pursuit, and spiritual experience, and all sharing with others, all sorts of other things, all wrapped up into one. And it's going to be a hell of an experience for us. And this doesn't contradict what Eliezer said about having medical care and cheap energy and being able to teleport around and all that good stuff either. So
I did not say teleportation.
Oh, okay. I did.
Well, you didn't rule it out at any point.
Coming soon to a Walmart near you.
Okay, so Jay, before we leave this,
let me ask Ben one question. Ben,
No. Hey. Guess what? I'm the host of this show. You've asked enough questions.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
You're going to answer some questions now. So, the two others have given us a pretty nice world with artificial friendly intelligence, right? Friendly artificial intelligence. I'm digging this world pretty good. What with the empty hospitals and the I can have sex and write a novel at the same time. Now, is that the world you foresee with friendly artificial intelligence, or would you view it differently?
You who?
You, James.
Oh, you, James. Okay. I guess I'll reframe my question I was going to ask Ben as a statement, which is that I'm totally down with the frame that Ben provides. You know, I want to see all those human enhancement capabilities. But I don't see why we want to have self-willed, super-intelligent machines with sentience as an enabler of that. I mean, I think that what the folks like Ben have suggested about the field of artificial intelligence is that there's lots of progress being made at extending various human capabilities through limited artificial intelligence. But that there aren't very many people working on this artificial general intelligence, which is human cognition. And so far as I can tell, that's a good thing, because the extension of specific human capabilities will be a far greater and more predictable enabler of human enhancement than the creation of these human mimics or the mimics of human cognition in machines, which could be very unpredictable.
Well, I'd be happy to respond to that.
Sure. Go ahead. Yeah.
First of all, I think that working on enhancement of human capabilities while leaving the basic human cognitive motivational structure intact, I think that has a very predictable outcome, which is destruction of all humanity. So I agree it's predictable, and I don't think it's a good thing. I think that the human mind structure is fundamentally limited and flawed in many ways, which has to do with the reasons for which our intelligence evolved, and that the only kind of mind that's going to be able to cope with the various technologies we're developing is a mind that's fundamentally differently structured than we are, without fuck, fight, and food at its center. And so I do think we need to create massively superhuman, super intelligent minds which are structured very differently than humans, and I don't think this has to mean that humans are destroyed. I do think it means that a lot of us are going to sort of gradually merge into these minds and gradually lose the humanity of our mind structure.
Ben, if the problem is that we have fuck, fight, and food as our motivational structure, why don't we just change human brains? I mean, why do we have to create these pure silicon brains without fuck, fight,
because and food? Because we can! Sorry, I just had to say that.
Yeah, well, I thought that was the answer.
We need a sinister laugh to accompany that, I think, actually. Nicely done.
That was pretty good.
Well, you're suggesting that we create fundamentally non-human minds using the wetware of human brains as their computation substrate, and that...
Well, you're the one who brought up the Buddha.
That might well be possible, but I'm not sure why you would want to do that. If you're going to create a fundamentally non-human mind, why not use a more powerful substrate to do so?
You're the one who brought up the Buddha. I mean, that's basically the Buddhist proposition, is that you can, through self-examination, transcend the algorithms that create suffering and violence.
Well, but that's true, but only by introducing other pretty severe limitations. And this was one of my frustrations during my own earlier flirtation with Buddhism. I mean, the Zen masters who I encountered and the other exalted spiritual leaders, I mean, these were just great people, and you feel a sense of peace in their presence that you don't normally feel, yet clearly, achieving that state of mind within the confines of the human brain shuts out a lot of other things. I mean, these guys are not making scientific revolutions because their entire brain is involved in maintaining this great state of inner peace. So I think there are limitations in what you can achieve using the human brain as a computational infrastructure. And I'd like to go beyond these limitations. A lot of others would as well, and that's really what underlies Eliezer's because we can. I mean, we can, and a lot of us want to go beyond these limitations.
Well, as I said, I do too, but I just don't see why we want to create de novo artificial minds as an enabler of that.
If I can sort of ask a question at this point of both Ben and James, suppose we remove all the fear, all the technical problems, and, you know, we've already got an advanced friendly AI in hand. It's completely other interested, and there's no need to rush ahead and merge with it for fear of being outcompeted. There's no need to merge as opposed to specifying exactly what you want to do. James, there's no reason why you've got to rush in to human enhancement in order to beat AI to the punch. You can just take it as slow as you like, as fast as you like, move in whatever direction you like. If you could have it whichever way you wanted, what exactly would a human grow up into, at what sort of pace, what sort of trajectory? I don't expect you to know the whole answer to that, but just any sort of thoughts on the subject as to what you want. We can compromise and decide we can't get what we want later, but first we have to decide what you actually want.
Well, Ellie, as I've told you before, what you're proposing with that is the notion of a benevolent monarchy, or not even benevolent monarchy, a benevolent deity. And if we had actual benevolent deities in the world, I think all kinds of things would be possible. We could achieve all kinds of wonderful things. I just don't believe in the prospect of benevolent deities.
Okay, but I'm trying to get, what do you want?
What do I want?
Right.
I want a world in which all sentient beings, more or less egalitarianly, have a discussion about how to move forward together towards greater and greater achievement of transcendence and possibility.
Then what
it's
would
pretty
you
similar.
Call for?
It's pretty much similar to what Ben already said. It's just I don't want there to be an all-powerful deity created out of silicon that somehow rules us all with its one ring.
Yes, but what would you actually vote for in that great vote? Like, what's your actual, you're a voter too, so what are you going to vote for?
Well, that's the wonderful thing about a conversation, is that it can go all different kinds of ways. So, I mean, that's precisely, I mean, you have proposed in the past that there would, that this benevolent deity god machine would just discern what all of our interests are going to be and tell us what we should be doing on the basis of its greater intelligence than ours. And I don't want to have that kind of future. I want to have a future in which we determine together through conversation what we're going to do as a species.
Okay, well,
so the AI,
I'd like to move on from this, if we could. We've got a couple more topics we did want to hit this evening. But the benevolence thing, I think, dovetails nicely into the next topic that you were going to bring up, Stephen.
Absolutely. And I'm going to address this to Eliezer. Eliezer, let's go completely to the dark side here. Instead of a benevolent deity, we get something awful. What's more likely? Do we get Terminator, or do we get something that ignores us and goes off into the universe and we just miss the boat?
You get something that ignores us and transforms its available local resources into, you know, configurations of maximal efficiency for achieving its goals. And you do happen to be made out of atoms that can be used for something else. The Terminator scenario, in terms of marching armies of robots with glowing red eyes, that's a bit implausible. They do that in the movies because if you just have Bambi versus Godzilla and you instantly go squish and get disassembled by nanomachines, you know, there's not much of a movie plot around it.
Right.
But okay. Like Battlestar Galactica, that's realistic, right?
I'm afraid I haven't seen that show, sorry.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
That's a shame. Well, but I guess my point is, even if it's okay, so it's Bambi versus Godzilla, or I guess your point is, it doesn't really matter from our point of view whether it's something that ignores us and transforms us into something it thinks is useful, or if something's out to get us. Either way, if we come up with something awful, it's the end of the road for us. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I actually think it's exceedingly unlikely to, you know, have it in for you on any personal level that leads you it to suspend your brain in a jar forever, being subjected to hallucinated experiences of intense torture or anything like that. Because if anyone sort of screws up in reaching into mind design space, they're not going to get that. They're going to get an AI that's obsessed with cheesecakes or paperclips or something. Or transforming the whole universe into tiny smiley faces because it was trained on pictures of smiling humans as that which it is supposed to achieve, or and so on and so forth. But if it doesn't care about you one way or the other, you are made out of useful atoms.
Okay. All right. James, what do you think is more likely? Something that's going to ignore us and transform us into something useful, or something that's out to get us?
Well, I agree with Ellie, actually. I don't think that the most likely outcome is something that hates us, because I think the most likely outcome is something that has such an alien mentality to ours that it may not even recognize that we exist. And therefore, it's far more dangerous in a sense, because we don't even know how to fight it. We don't have how to argue with it. It doesn't value the same things that we value. So, you know, one prospect is that, it could see, the various forms of intelligence, like the Dow Jones stock market, as more intelligent than we are, and try to communicate with it instead. But at any rate, I don't think the Terminator with robots or the Battlestar Galactica Cylons is a particularly likely outcome. But I think something that could be so radically disruptive and harmful to human interests is a rather likely outcome. And I think it's far more proximate. One of the things that I worry about is structural unemployment as a consequence of automation. And I know that for the singularitarians, they think that artificial intelligence is going to blow past that point so quick that the point at which we worry about machines doing work for us may only be a couple of years before they're not doing work for us anymore. But if we, in the very near future, it may be that machines take over so much human work that there's structural unemployment for human beings, and that could be really disruptive for life on this planet.
What's interesting about that is that you have these suboptimal or even very negative scenarios rising out of everything working theoretically okay, where the friendly AI is being perfectly friendly and it's being perfectly nice, and then maybe things don't work out as well, either because it's not doing something correctly, to use one of Ellie's examples earlier, or because there's unintended consequences associated with the good that it's doing. Or, Jay, just to go back to your earlier point, even if it's doing everything right, and suddenly we don't have a say anymore, right? We've just become kind of these kept creatures. There's a potential downside, I guess, as great to a friendly artificial intelligence as to a friendly one. Is that fair to say?
Exactly. Very well put. I think the unintended consequences is what comes out of, for instance, the structural unemployment consideration. You see this also with the autonomous warbot debate. You can say that we're going to program warbots with human codes of war so that they act ethically on the battlefield. But when they're acting in nanosecond time frames, we're not really in control anymore. we're trying to set it up so that we hope that they act as we would hope that they would on the battlefield, but really they're going to be reacting in a time frame that's totally beyond our control. So, I think there are a lot of potential unintended consequences even before we get to the point of superhuman intelligence.
Okay, so let me add that option as I throw this one over to Ben. Ben, what would you view as potentially a greater risk from things things going pear-shaped with artificial intelligence? Is it the overtly hostile, the one that ignores us and, you know, turns us into fodder of some kind, or the one that's trying to do something nice and ends up via unintended consequences really making us miserable?
Neither. In my view, the greatest risk is an AI which is not that autonomous and is controlled by human beings with selfish and malevolent ends. I think that's by far the greatest danger we face. I think we're placing the wrong focus and worrying about what the superhuman AIs are going to do to us. We should be more worried about what we're going to use roughly human-level AIs to do to each other.
Okay, great point. I guess we assumed autonomous. You know, in the movies they're always autonomous, right? So that's where Stephen and I were coming from. We didn't think that one through to the people pulling the strings.
I mean, of the two options you propose, I would be more afraid of nasty AIs than of benevolent but misguided AIs. But neither of those is what scares me the most.
Fair enough. Okay, well, I think we've got time for one more question to toss around to the group, and then we'll hopefully have time for any final comments. Actually, before we go to our final question, Michael, do we have any questions from the online chat?
Well, aside from the lively discussion, a question did come up when there was a mention made of a documentary film. We want to hear more about the film, and I think that's the only thing I'll throw out at present.
Okay, Ben, can you tell us the title of that film and when we can look for it, either on DVD or in our local independent cinema?
Which film is that?
You said you were working on a documentary film?
I'm not working on it, but Raj Dai is making it, and I will be prominently featured in it. But the title is not yet determined, so I can't tell you that. But I will certainly let you know when the title and the film are a little further along. I mean, he's got a bunch of film footage that he made in Hong Kong and in Xiamen, China, and he's deep into the editing now.
Oh, okay, great. Well, maybe we'll get Raj on one of these
That'd
weeks.
Be great. Yeah.
Yeah, he can tell us how that's going. Terrific. Anything else, Michael? Was that it? I'll take that as a that's it. Okay. Now, final question for the panel. And that is, we've talked about strong AI, artificial general intelligence, friendly, not so friendly. Let's put on our Ray Kurzweil caps here and start making some serious predictions. When does AGI show up, and how do we prepare for that, or how do we get ready for that, or what do we need to do in the meantime? I guess would be the other side of. The other side of preparing, and we'll start this one out with Ellie. What do you think?
I have no idea when this is going to happen. If I knew exactly how to build a friendly AI, and I knew exactly what people like I would employ to build it, and I had a whole project chart laid out in front of me, I still wouldn't be able to tell you when it would be finished because of this little thing called project management chaos. And since I don't actually know any of these things, to predict it is beyond hopeless. It's waiting on a basic research breakthrough, and those can come at any time, near term, far term. Roll 3d6 and raise it to an unknown exponent. I really have no idea when it's going to happen, and so I just try to get my research done as quickly as I can.
Well, can I ask a related question then? These research breakthroughs. I mean, have you seen some? As long as you've been in the field now, have you seen some of these research breakthroughs, or are you expecting any?
I think it has to do with the kind of AI I want to build has to do with sort of very fundamental questions like how do you have an AI that modifies the part of itself that does the self-modifying in a provably correct fashion without going into an infinite loop and exploding in a shower of Gödelian inconsistency.
And progress like that, I mean, the whole Gödel thing at the beginning of the 20th century, well, that was some progress of a sort. It at least told us where one of the problems might be. The invention of Bayesian probability theory a few hundred years ago, that was a lot of progress. But this is the invention of new mathematics we're talking about. And it's even hard to tell what in the last decade could have been possibly progress, and because we don't yet know what pieces of the puzzle we're going to use and which pieces we throw away. It's long, slow, difficult work. Now, if you're talking about the more general sort of AI research that whereby, you know, AI, you, someone might just throw together an AI that they don't really understand very well and wipes out the world, well, progress is proceeding apace on that. We've got faster computers always decrease the amount of intelligence you need to build one of these things, which is not a good thing. Moore's Law of Mad Science, the minimum IQ necessary to destroy the world, keeps drops by one IQ point every 18 months. So sure, there's all sorts of progress, but until the world is saved or destroyed, we won't know which parts of it were important.
Okay.
I guess hindsight's always 20/20 with those things, huh?
Yeah.
Same question over to you, Ben. What Ellie has said that it's useless to try to make a prediction, so I'm going to continue asking people to make predictions. What do you think? When do we see these things happen?
Unlike Eliezer, I do think I know how to make a human-level AI, and I do have a project plan with charts and specific tasks and a team working on it. So I can say if my design for AGI is correct, if we keep going at the pace we are now, it'll probably take us another 20, 25 years. If my design is correct, and we got a massive increase in the amount of funding, it's feasible we could be there within 10 years. You can't say that with any certainty. Now, setting aside my own particular project, on which my attitude may, of course, be biased in various ways, and looking at this situation more broadly, I find I'm in broad agreement with Ray Kurzweil, but I'm not as confident as him to put a specific year on it and say, yes, human-level AI in 2029, singularity in 2045. I would say I'd be pretty surprised if a human-level AI was created next year. I'd be pretty surprised if a human-level AI was not created by the end of this century, by 2100. And if it happens between 2030 and 2050, I won't be surprised at all. I think there's a wide confidence interval. It could happen sooner than people think through my project or somebody else's, and there could be obstacles that we're not now foreseeing. So that's, I think a more important point really is that it is possible. It's almost surely possible using the kind of computers that we know how to build, but possibly bigger and faster ones, and using the kind of knowledge that we know how to collect it and create. And I think that's really the key point, rather than exactly what year or decade it comes about. And in terms of your other question of what we can do to prepare for it, that's a really interesting question. It's like asking what can you do to prepare for the complete unknowns, right? And
exactly, yeah.
The only answer I can think of is, you know, learn as much as you can, become as broad and diverse in your thinking as you can, and learn not to approach things with too many preconceived notions, because whatever happens, it's likely to violate all of our assumptions.
Okay. Good advice for living, also, in addition to getting ready for artificial general intelligence. All right, Jay, we're going to send this one over to you. What do you think? You got a time frame for us or thoughts on how to get ready for this massive transformation?
Well, I defer to Ben and to Kurzweil on timelines for plausibility. I think I have always believed in the eventual possibility of human level machine minds and or sentient machine minds since I was a teenager, just on the basis of, you know, materialist expectations about the fact that intelligence is a material phenomenon. It's not supernatural, and therefore it will eventually be modelable in machines. So I'm pretty confident that it will eventually be achieved, and it seems, like Ben says, pretty likely in this century. But I guess one of the things that I know that Ben also agrees with is that it's not necessary to only be achieved in a particular machine, that it might in fact be an emergent phenomenon out of all the buzz and whir of communication and information technology in the world. And so that gives me pause that we may see forms of artificial life and artificial mind emerge out of the net that we are not anticipating, that might be far stranger than we have imagined. And so the next thing, how do we prepare for artificial minds, especially if they are malevolent or at least not friendly to human interests in some way? I've been thinking a lot about, over the last year, the concept of resilience, civilizational resilience, because it's such a useful concept to face all the different technological and non-technological risks that our civilization faces. How do we become more resilient as a civilization? How can we ensure that if the net were to go down, or if, you know, electricity were to go down, or agriculture were to go down for one reason or another, that we would all have a chance at keeping it going? And I think that that's what we have to think about. So what does it mean to have a more resilient information infrastructure so that if something were to get loose, some kind of a life were to emerge or to get loose on the net, that we would be able to survive it and contain it and fight it? How can we do that? That's why I think we need to have a dialogue between the singularitarians and the cybersecurity folks, a dialogue that I haven't seen enough of yet. So that's one of the things I've been pressing for, is that we need to be talking to the folks who are fighting things like botnets, which I think are an early emergent form of A-life out there being used in the malevolent ways that Ben worries that future A-life or future AI may be used.
Okay, so that's a conversation we need to encourage, and that actually is a tremendous place for us to end, because our topic next week is existential risk, and of course we'll be getting into exactly some of those issues. Although I want to say that it's interesting when you mentioned resiliency built into the systems. It seems that dovetails very nicely with the kind of resiliency that Ben was talking about that we need to adopt for ourselves, for our own ways of thinking and our own approach to life. So
absolutely.
I want to thank all three of our panelists. We're very close to our time here. Eliezer Yudkowsky, Ben Gertzel, and James Hughes. Gentlemen, thank you all very much. What a pleasure to have you on the program this evening. The time flew by faster than we ever would have expected, but we look forward to talking with each of you again in the very near future. Stephen, thank you. Stephen, what's our music this evening?
Well, 40 years ago today, a couple of guys were on the moon, enjoying their second day, I believe, on the moon. So tonight's song is Moon Song, and the band is iSynthesis. So hope you guys enjoy.
iSynthesis singing Moon Song. Just a historical note there. I'm not sure they spent the night that first moon trip, but we'll have to double check the records on that. Either way, historically, it's right in the spirit of the times. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thanks for your contributions to the program. Michael, to you and all our friends in the chat room, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. Everyone listening live and all of you listening via MP3, we look forward to talking with you again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.
cross the line. Nothing ever seems good. Use of my mind. Looking for a blue moon, and I'd try to adjust. All the things they told me, still I'd do what I must.
Take this to control.